From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on February 26th at the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the day the justices heard oral submissions in a case that could redefine union membership and worker rights in this country, depending on who you're reading. The case is Janus versus AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Mark Janus is a social worker in Illinois who decided he didn't want to pay union fees because he's not a member of the union. Janus has said he believes his free speech rights are violated because he's been forced to pay union fees. Why? Well, he says he believes that unions contribute to causes and candidates he does not support. He doesn't want his fees used in that way, so he doesn't want to pay at all. But the law says unions are allowed to charge workers some minimal fees for the service of collective bargaining. In other words, Janus stands to benefit from the work the union does, whether he is a member or not, so he can be charged some small fees. This is a very important case, and the Supreme Court will decide it this year. 2 years ago, the court heard a similar case and split 4-4 following the death of Antonin Scalia. This time around, with Neil Gorsuch on the court, the expectation is that Janus will win. And the headlines say it'll be a loss for unions. That could turn the entire country into a so-called right-to-work zone, a victory for anti-union forces. Conservatives have been very excited about this case. That is just one of the subjects we're going to discuss this hour, try to understand it better with our guests. The leaders of New York State United Teachers are in Rochester today. Andy Pallotta is NYSET president. Andy, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Jolene DeBrango is executive vice president of NYSET, as well as a former teacher in the Pittsford School District. So welcome back, I guess.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's good to be home.
Yeah, let our listeners know where you taught, Jolene.
I taught at Barker Road Middle School in the Pittsford Central School District, and I absolutely loved being a middle school teacher. It was almost a 25-year career out here in this area.
Most of your work is in Albany now?
Yes, all of my work is in Albany now. I had to relocate.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I do miss the Rochester area. I miss it very much.
Well, welcome back here. Andy, what brings both of you to Rochester today?
Well, we have meetings with our local leaders, and it's very exciting to be here and just discuss the items that are very important to all of our members throughout the entire state and hear from the folks in the Rochester region.
We have a lot to talk about this hour. We're going to talk state budget. We're going to talk about teaching jobs and a feared teacher shortage, what that means. We're going to talk about testing and the amount of testing that students have to deal with, parents have to deal with as well. But we've got to start, I think, and we'll get back to the Janus case, but we've got to start, I think, with what happened this morning at 10 a.m. We saw thousands of students across the country, probably hundreds of thousands, walking out, for 17 minutes, some holding their own most of the day events, demonstrating against gun violence, calling for changes to gun laws, and this, of course, in response and in solidarity with the students in Parkland, Florida. Andy, what do you make of what you saw from students around the state today?
I'm proud of what they did. We're proud of the educators that were with them and the parents also. They are standing up for what they believe, that enough is enough, that the culture, the gun culture, has been so destructive to this generation, and it is time for government to actually step up and do something.
Tomorrow you will hear from some of the students who did walk out today. They're going to be on this program tomorrow. Jolene, how did you feel about what you saw from students?
As a teacher, it's incredible to see students actually doing the things that you always teach them about, you know, to raise their voice, to speak truth to power, the power of the collective, being there for one another. When you see something that's wrong, standing up and saying that. And so to see this not only in this area, but across the country, it gives us great hope as educators that the next generation that we're teaching are really going to change this world. And that's really what teaching is all about. So to see those lessons come true, it was really powerful today.
As a person who's been a teacher, Jillian, I wanted to ask you specifically about a question that's come up from a number of listeners who are parents. And I ask this because it's interesting if you Google and do some research about response to mass shootings. There's a New York Times headline from 1999, surge of interest in homeschooling. You know, parents were scared after Columbine. After most mass shootings, there is at least a surge in inquiries. But we've never seen a school mass shooting result in a spike in homeschooling. It's just never happened. I'm not saying it couldn't happen. Historically, it has not happened. What I'm starting to hear from parents is what will tip that for me is if you arm teachers. I've heard that from a number of parents. Now, listeners, again, I don't mean to paint a monolithic brush, and maybe some listeners disagree with that. But I was struck by how many parents reached out, emailed, talked to the program saying, that would do it. I would get much more serious and actually think about homeschooling if we put guns in the classroom. I wonder how nice it feels about that. And as a former teacher, how you feel about that?
Well, I'll start first with, as a former teacher, I would not want to be armed. I don't believe that my colleagues want to be armed, and NYSET's position is that we should not arm teachers. We completely disagree with the notion that teachers are law enforcement officers. We are educators, we're nurturers. Because of the constraints that we're under as public educators, we're often social workers, psychologists, we're many things. But what we are not is law enforcement. And our schools are safe, nurturing places. That's what we want them to be. We don't want to harden our schools. And we believe that the appropriate response to this violence is to be sure that each community has a voice in how to make sure that students are protected, whether that's, we hope, increased funding for those services that would address mental health issues and provide kids with what they need to be sure that nobody ever gets to the point where they want to come into a school and harm other people.
Do you understand the disposition of parents who are saying, I would actually think about homeschooling if you did that?
I can understand parents being fearful of schools turning into armed camps. It's not what they are. They're places to learn. They're places to grow, to experiment, to be creative. And teachers are meant to teach. And I can understand a parent's position that they don't want schools to become armed camps.
Andy Pallotta, as the president of NYSET, you've got plenty of experience in seeing issues that are either negotiated or debated. Is this one of those issues that you think it's not going to happen, or do you think this is going to be a fight? Do you think that we really could see some places where there's a push to arm teachers, at least some teachers or some percentage of teachers?
I don't think there's going to be a push to arm the teachers in this state. I think most people realize that that is not the best way to go. If a community wants a school resource officer, if they want someone in the building that is armed, one district has chosen to hire retired police officers to be armed security. That is a community decision, with the local control being a chief advocacy point of NYSET all the time. I believe that that would be something we would leave up to them.
What is at the top of the list for NYSET, if there's anything? I mean, if this is a priority, and I don't say that flippantly, I mean, there's a lot of things that you're working on, but since Parkland, there's been a lot of talk about, if not this, then this. What do you think is achievable to create safer schools for students and for teachers?
Right. What we need is real discussion at the local level, and if the decision is made that we want to be able to hire folks, use these Smart Schools Bond Act money to have bulletproof glass, cameras, whatever it is that they deem necessary, then that should be done. So we don't believe that teachers should carry guns in school. I never believed that. I also taught for 24 years in New York City schools.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jillian, what do you think?
Yes, I would reiterate what Andy said about the Smart Schools Bond Act. There is money available, and we are hearing from across the state that it is simply taking too long to get this money into schools' hands. There are many schools that are depending upon that money to implement safety changes, and so whatever can be done to expedite that process really must be done right now. We need to put our money where our mouths are.
Andy Pallotta and Jolene DeBrango are here from NYSET, the NYSET president and executive vice president. They are in Rochester today and joining us for the hour. And we're going to move the discussion in a lot of different directions. But listeners, if you want to join the program, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Depending on the headline you read about the Janus case, that we are on the verge of becoming a so-called right-to-work country, because the expectation is that with Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court in June, we're going to get a decision, and that Mark Janus is going to win his case, an Illinois social worker, and that it's going to become optional, paying union fees. A lot of people won't do it, and it's going to change the landscape entirely. Andy, what's right and what's wrong about that? Let's start with sort of the broad outlines of this case as you see it, and then we'll talk about what the implications are.
Right, well, big picture here is fair share. Seems to be something we learn about in kindergarten. If you get something, you should be part of something and also share the burden for it. So in this, I'm sure that Mr. Janus has done well by having a union in his benefits, his health benefits, his pay, retirement security. So all along, it has been fine. And now we have some very big moneyed interests, corporate interests, that are bankrolling this case. So we always have to follow, where is the money coming from to bankroll something like this? And they would profit the most by diminishing the ability of unions to advocate for their members and those we serve.
Okay. And when it comes to your expectations here, do you agree with sort of the conventional wisdom that with Gorsuch replacing Scalia, this is going to be a 5-4 vote?
Well, it looks like that. And we're going to wait for this decision to see just how it will impact unions and public servants throughout this country.
All right. So here's a couple of comments from very different points of views from our listeners. First of all, this is from Jay, who is a Democratic organizer, writing to us from Philadelphia. He says, Evan, remember the collapse of union organizing is the main reason so many working class white voters have lapsed back into blaming people of color for their problems. Solidarity often has overcome ethnic rivalries. An overt appeal to working people, not middle class, but working, is possibly the biggest thing Democrats have been missing. And union busting is a big problem in this country. I wonder how you feel about Jay's email there.
Well, I believe that unions equalize and bring all boats up in the harbor. So I believe that folks, people of color and white folks and just working class people need someone to speak for them. And unions have been that voice for all these years. It has helped in labor relations throughout our state, that's for sure. And I believe that anything that harms that will hurt working class people and the middle class.
Now, here's a very different email. This is from Edward, who writes this morning. He said, Evan, the issue I have with unions is that they only support Democrats these days. As a Republican, I completely understand the frustration that some workers have with how their dues are used. We should have the right not to join, and I don't understand why this is even controversial. The workers that want to join can still join, right? Explain this to me, Andy.
Okay. As far as politics and Democrat versus Republican, NYSIT has a very clear 3-day convention where we do endorsements and we do endorse on both sides of the aisle. There are more Democrats that support labor unions, and that being the case most of the time, we will support those who support us. Those who support more funding for public education, of course we would want to support them.
All right, so you're saying it's logical for NYSED to support Democrats.
It is logical, and we do support many Republicans in these statewide races.
Okay, but by and large, you support more Democrats than Republicans.
Yes.
Okay, so why don't you explain to Edward, who says, all I want to do is have the right to say, look, I'm not going to join. My colleagues who want to join will join. You got the dues from them. You won't have them from me. What's the big deal? Give me that freedom.
And the freedom not to pay a fair share is really not a good way to go in any organization. So by profiting someone else's labor, which is not paying your fair share, you're still getting the same contract, you're still getting the same benefits, that same health care. Could that person really try and negotiate those same things on their own? I would say good luck to them.
Okay, so Jolene, this sounds like Edward, the message to Edward is, you can't just pay nothing if you're going to stand to benefit from the work of collective bargaining, the work of a union. Is that the idea?
Absolutely. And I believe Edward in his email stated that his dues dollars were being used for political purposes. And in our union, that is not the case. So we have a voluntary contribution fund where our members are able to contribute what they would like, you know, whether it's a little bit in their paycheck or in a lump sum, and that goes toward political advocacy. No dues dollars are used for political purposes, so that needs to be clearly delineated as well, because sometimes that's misinformation that's out there.
I want to grab a phone call from Ithaca. This is Todd on the line first up. Go ahead, Todd.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I'm a NYSED member. I am teaching right now. This is my 30th year, going into my last 2 years. I've been a former president of my local. And, you know, if this law went through, I might not pay the union dues because my local's not really working for me when I'm writing to them and asking them questions and I'm being ignored. So how does a local member, you know, get their union to be responsive to them about issues that are important?
All right. So stay there, Todd, if you could. Andy, Jolene, you want to tackle that? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm saddened to hear that because I was a former local leader and felt a real responsibility, as I believe most of our union leaders do, to be responsive to their members. I think that you most certainly should be reaching out not only locally but regionally to our staff for assistance on how to make sure that your voice is heard and that your needs are being met, because that is certainly our top priority. I know as a local leader, like you're saying, you're teaching right now. Most of our local leaders are also teachers full-time, and they do their union work outside of work hours. And so everyone is very busy and very stretched. I'd want to be sure that people are able to have that work-life balance but also be responsive to their members. So anything that our regional offices can do, and certainly you can reach out to us as officers, and we'd be more than happy to speak with you and your local leader about ways that we can help you and make sure that your voice is heard. So please feel free to reach out.
I've reached out to the labor relations specialists and gotten some satisfaction there, but they can't tell the local what to do. And the large portion of the dues go to the state and go to the national affiliates. Very little goes to the local. And I want the local working on local things, not resending out things that the state or the national AFT does. I want the local really being responsive to local issues.
We definitely hear that. And I would encourage you to, once we're off the air here, to be sure that you reach out to Andy and I personally, and we would love to talk to you more about this.
Sure. We've been reaching out to our members throughout the state and trying to make that connection of what union values really are and what's important to you. So this is our initiative. This is why we exist. We exist for the members and those they serve. So we would want to hear what the issues are. We even have a door knocking campaign now where we have close to 300 of our own members knocking doors throughout the state, talking to our own members about what is important, what's on their mind. So This is really our initiative now, just the exact thing you're talking about.
Even in the workplace, we're having one-to-one conversations. So we would hope that you would be reached out to on a one-to-one basis from another member of your local and asked what we can do for you. That really should be the conversation. What do you need? What can we do for you? And so we want to be sure that that's happening, and we're happy to speak with you more about that.
All right, in Rochester, this is Teta next on the phone. Go ahead, Teta.
Hi. I had the privilege of being the first ever union representative mandated. The state of New Jersey required young doctors, residents, and interns to have a union, but only less than 4% belonged. They elected me union rep. They hadn't had one in 23 years. And I had a very simple point of view, fair share, repeating what Andy said. We were going to negotiate a new contract. We'd gone without one for 2 years. We were earning a lot less than the private interns and residents in the private hospitals. And I've said it's very, very fair. If you pay union dues when we negotiate a better contract, you will benefit. If not, you'll be in the second tier, which doesn't get the changes in benefits because you didn't join and you're not getting a fair share. At the end of the year, we had 84% membership in the union, and three people competed for a thankless job with no pay, which you had to do after your 90-hour work week. Three people competed to be elected for a job that nobody had wanted for 23 years. It's simple. Civics. Fair share.
Yeah, Teta, thank you.
Powerful to hear something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm thinking of listeners like Edward who are supporting the Janus side of the Janus case, saying, well, but you don't need to force people to pay. You could just tell them that if you don't pay your dues, then you don't get the benefits of collective bargaining.
But I don't believe that we are certain that the case will actually play out in that manner. So That's what we're waiting to see, all of the details of what might be decided.
What do you assume, Andy, is going to happen when this is a 5-4 decision in June in favor of Janus? Does this, for conservative listeners who are thinking this makes a right-to-work world now, this is Wisconsin everywhere, this is Indiana everywhere, this is whatever the case may be, what in your view is sort of, from your perspective, the worst case scenario? From maybe some conservatives would enjoy hearing this, but from your perspective, what's the worst case that comes out of this?
I'm not going to tell them.
Come on.
Okay, so the worst case scenario would mean a diminished voice for teachers in their schools, for our own members, and we do have members who work in hospitals. NYSED has a ton of members that work in hospitals throughout the state. So again, why would we want to diminish the voice of a working person and their working conditions? I believe we have a better standard of living and better benefits here because we have strong unions in New York State. 24% of the workforce is organized in New York State.
Now, for the teachers, for the union members who are worried that this case portends the ends of unions as we know it. I mean, there are some pretty apocalyptic headlines out there tied to this case. Could that happen? Could we see unions starting to dissolve? And what would you say to members who are concerned about what this means for NYSED and other memberships?
Okay, could unions be hurt? Unions could be hurt by this, but I believe that our members know the value of being part of a union, a statewide union that works on their behalf. So I would think that they would want to stick with their union.
Do you think that this decision will put you in a position where you have to essentially recruit, tell people, you got a choice now, but we need you? Is that going to be what happens?
We are already doing that.
Okay.
There are choices out there.
You're not waiting until June.
Right. We are not waiting. We are not going to be sitting on our hands. We are out there already speaking with our own members. What is important to them? What do they need from their union?
All right. That's Andy Pallotta, NYSED president, and Jolene DeBrango, executive vice president. They are in Rochester today. Drew in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Drew.
Hi, I have a question. I don't think first-year members of a government agency should be forced to pay union dues. I had a situation with a supervisor, and because I was on probation, the union could not represent me until I passed probation. But yet, still, I was still forced to pay union dues. Can they address that?
Go ahead, guys.
Well, he's speaking about a government job.
Yeah.
Okay. So as teachers, as educators, we have probationary periods of time as well before a teacher becomes a tenured member of the faculty. However, while they don't have the same rights as a tenured member, the union is working for that member. Safety conditions in a workplace, having professional voice to make sure that people do have a voice when it comes to decisions that are being made about their professional life, making sure that the issues that are important to them do get raised and do get addressed, even if they were on probation. So while the due process rights may differ, that is just one piece of what a union does, but all of the other pieces are still there surrounding that person. And as educators in particular, you know, our union provides professional development for our members. They're the ones that are often a part of any kind of mentoring program. So there are wraparound services and other things that we can provide, even if due process rights differ from a probationary member to a tenured member. But the union is there. The salary, the benefits, those are all things that were negotiated for that probationary member.
Drew, does that help?
That helps a little bit, but it's still the crux of the situation is if you felt that you were being not treated fairly and you're paying union dues and you want to keep your job, but the union can't represent you because you're on probation. To me, that was my situation. So all that other stuff comes with being, I guess, the other benefits that she talks about. I understand that, but I'm talking about probationary period. If you can't get same representation as someone that's past probation, I don't think you should be forced to pay union dues on probation. That's all I'm saying.
Okay,
but
thank you.
I understand what the lady is saying.
Sure, yeah. Drew, I appreciate the phone call. Anything you want to add there, Andy, Jolene? Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls, and this is Eric in Fairport next. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I work for a BOCES, and I'm aware that BOCES doesn't have the same access to money for the support and school security as our districts do. I was curious about what NYSED's doing to help make this more even, make this more level, because we get some, we have some special cases here of students, different types of students who need different supports, and having, you know, equal access to security would be beneficial.
All right, thanks for the phone call, Eric.
One of the things we do at NYSIT at the Capitol is we have lobby days, and one of those was a BOCES lobby day. So we bring folks from around the state, they bring students with them, and we go speak to legislators about just the same exact issue that you just brought up. So whether it's safety, whether it's funding, we have advocated on behalf of the BOCES schools for many years, and I believe that it is very effective for legislators not only to hear it from the professionals, but also from the students. So again, the Smart Schools Bond Act money, we've been advocating heavily on this to have that efficiently run and gotten to the school districts throughout the state.
Okay. Yep. Jillian, you want to add to that?
Just in addition to the lobbying that we do, through NYSIT, we have a BOCES Policy Council that was created a few years ago so that our BOCES professionals could come to NYSIT directly and set the priorities for things like Lobby Day and other types of policy changes that we would like to see made that would directly impact BOCES professionals and their students. So we continue to make sure that our BOCES employees have a voice, the same type of voice as the rest of our K-12 staff. So we appreciate everything that our BOCES employees do. It's a special place, and it's a wonderful place. They're doing some of the most innovative teaching you can find anywhere in New York State with their CTE programs and the variety of programs that they offer. So I encourage everyone to get to know their local BOCES better.
All right, and Henrietta, this is Joan next on the phone. Go ahead, Joan.
Yes, I moved here from Northern Virginia, which is a right-to-work state, and I was a dental hygiene instructor, and my boss moved there from Manhattan, and she tried to start a union, and she was told if she did that, she'd be fired. No ifs, ands, or buts. So I think that's what you have to be more scared, I think, about the right-to-work states than those that allow unions.
Thank you, Joan. Well, Joan's experience lines up with John's question. A different listener named John just called to ask, how do you start a union in your workplace without getting fired? I don't know if NYSIT has any counsel on that, but you want to weigh in on what you just heard from Joan and John's question about the idea of even raising the idea of starting a union and then losing a job?
Right. Well, I believe that's horrendous, and that's what we're fighting against. We believe that folks do have a right to join a union and have a collective voice. It has been tremendously important for the school systems throughout the state when it comes time to advocate for so many things, whether it's safety or health, whatever it is, a collective voice always works better. And I feel bad for the person who tried to organize down in Virginia, because a threat with losing your job is exactly why we need unions.
Okay. One more phone call before we take our half-hour break, and then we're going to talk a lot more about other issues, state budget, and a lot more to get to, state testing and more. But this is Robert in Fairport next. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. According to the Albany Times Union, New York government unions, received approximately $112 million in agency fees in 2016, and agency fees are fees paid by employees who are not members of the unions. Not member of the union, there are about 200,000 of these government employees that chose not to join. Apparently, before 1977, these agency fees were not even something that were charged union members, and it seemed that the union survived okay back then, so I'm kind of curious as to why this is so essential to the union. The second is that my understanding is that unions in the state especially the New York State United Teachers, are promoting a bill that would eliminate the right of government workers to drop out of unions at any time. Simple written notification to their employer. The union wants to rewrite that rule and require that people have the right to drop out, but only at a certain time period at the beginning of the school year.
All right, Robert.
About that.
Thank you. Let's work backwards there. Is that bill, and what can we say about that proposed, that legislative effort there?
That particular bill is probably mixed up with a lot of other bills that are working their way through the sausage maker of Albany politics. So we will see how that comes through.
What would it do if it passes?
I believe that that would give an open window. So rather than just having any wild west of dropping out of a union, there would be a certain time when you could drop out.
Why limit the time?
Just for the orderly procedures of being an organization like NYSET to actually have a funding stream that you can say, well, this is what is coming into the union. If it's just on and off, it's not not productive.
Okay, and Robert is also asking about all the way up till 1977, unions existing without fees, or NYSET existing without fees here. Jolene?
I believe he's referencing the Abood case. That's A-B-O-O-D for your listeners so that they can understand. And since that case, now there are agency fees. And he was basically asking, I believe, you know, so what you survived before, so what's the big deal now? But I think going back to what Andy was saying, that the power of the collective is really what we want to kind of protect. And certainly the folks that are agency fee payers right now are benefiting from all of the work that the union does. And we believe, and we're really hopeful, and we're working really hard at this, that if they understand that if that ability to be a fair share payer goes away, that there could be the loss of some of the things that they do hold dear, even though they're not a member of the union. So we're really hoping to make that distinction through our one-to-one work and our organizing within our union.
We're talking to two of the leaders of New York State United Teachers. The president of NYSET is Andy Pallotta, and Jolene DeBrango is executive vice president. By the way, they're both former teachers, and Jolene, a former Pittsford School District teacher. They're in Rochester today. This is our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to more of your questions for them, and we'll talk to them about teacher shortages, state budget, and a lot more next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, we sit down with students who walked out of school on Wednesday, demonstrating and calling for more restrictive gun laws, calling for safer schools. We'll talk to the students about what they want, what they think Wednesday's demonstration accomplished. In our second hour, Haudenosaunee women throughout history, their strength and contributions often overlooked. Not Thursday. Join the conversation on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On Twitter, Susan says, my union benefits far, far outweigh the dues I pay. I will continue to pay, no matter what the Supreme Court of the United States decides in that case. Gary writes to the program and wants to know about our guests from NYSET's views on charter schools. He wants to know if charters are used as a union-busting device, and he wants to know, does NYSET have plans to organize charter school teachers?
Well, number one, they are a very powerful force in this state, charter industry. And yes, we definitely organize charter schools. And we have, I think, about 14, 15 charter schools that have a union voice. And I believe they're...
In this state?
Yes.
Okay. And is that a number we should expect to grow, Andy?
I would love it to grow.
Do you agree with Gary's assessment that charters can be used as a union-busting device?
Well, it has been. And a lot of the money that they raise is used to only profit charter schools, and that money comes from the public school budget.
Okay. Listeners, if you want to call the program, more questions or comments for our guests from NYSET, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I was going to say state tests are coming up, but they're sort of always coming up. There's lots of tests. As a public school parent whose kid is eventually going to be in that mill, that's just part of the world that kids live in these days. I want to ask both of our guests what you think the ideal is, because my guess is it's not what it is now, but realistically what the ideal is and if there's some sort of a compromise that gets us there. I'll start with Jolene. What do you think?
With testing.
Yeah.
So obviously we have had standardized tests for a very long time, right? I took standardized tests as a child. However, the way that they are used now is not their intended, what their purpose was. And so now we believe that the testing regimen that our kids have been under has been too much, it's too extensive, there's too many days. Developmentally, we do not believe that all of these tests are necessarily valid. We do not, as educators, get the results back in a way that can actually help and inform instruction for the students that you currently have. And, you know, as a teacher, formative assessment was a huge part of what I did, and that was making sure that on a daily basis I was assessing my kids as I was going along and I was teaching them. I had control over that assessment because I created it. I was trained to create it. That's the job that I do as a professional. And then there are summative assessments, and those come at the end of learning. And even the tests now, they don't come at the end of the year. They come in the springtime when we still have plenty of time left in school for learning to occur. So these tests have been used for the wrong reason. We don't believe they're necessarily as valid as they should be. And we believe that it's putting our kids in a really tough spot because in addition to the testing being used just for children currently in this state, that's also a part of our teacher evaluation system. And so we believe that that needs to be changed as well. So there's multiple layers to the assessment debate.
Yeah, a couple of things here. First of all, how do you feel about the opt-out movement and parents and kids deciding to do that? Support it, oppose it?
NICET has a very strong and clear position that we support a parent's right to choose what is best for their child, and that includes opting out.
Okay, and when it comes to what is ideal, because in a second I want to talk about tying it to teacher evaluations, which I think is still a little bit separate than the question of what is the right kind of testing regimen. So what do you think would be ideal? If NICET could sort of write the policy on how kids are tested, what would it look like?
Well, first of all, I think that they're tested too much from outside sources. So I think we need to start trusting educators, and we need to start putting those tools back into the educators' hands. We're able to create assessments that are meaningful, that actually reflect what the curriculum is, and can assess our students. You know, I administered final exams to my kids that I worked on collaboratively with my colleagues. I always felt very good about giving that assessment to the kids. It was maybe an hour long. It assessed everything that they learned all year. And it was a great way for me to take a look at what we had done together, the journey that we had taken throughout the year. All of these state-mandated tests and federally mandated tests and testing companies getting involved, and there's this whole machine, and it just feels like our kids are in the middle of it. We need to put everything, I believe, back in the hands of our educators and trust them.
But
we need to rebuild trust.
But locally, Jolene, because it sounds to me like what you're saying is there shouldn't be statewide tests, that there should be all local tests.
I would love for there not to be statewide tests. This is my personal opinion as an educator of 25 years. I would love for there to be locally developed tests. I really would, instead of statewide tests, because each district is different, each community is different, and we need to start trusting our educators, the people that went to school and are highly educated in these in this work, to be able to assess the students that are before them all year long in their care, hours and hours a day.
In a moment, I'm going to take Tom in Brighton's call. He's got a question on teacher shortages, because there's been a lot of talk in recent years about what impacts anyone's desire to become a teacher, and sort of the climate of the debate about, to some degree, it's sort of pitted the governor against teachers. I think that's been a little less hot in recent years, and maybe Andy's going to tell me I'm wrong about that. But I am curious to know what kind of evaluation system. Andy, do we have to evaluate teachers? Because some people think, well, NICET just doesn't want teacher evaluations at all. Should there be teacher evaluations? Should they ever be tied to tests? What should they look like? Let's do the idealistic game, if you could draw up evaluations.
Should teachers be evaluated? Of course they should.
Okay.
We should all be evaluated. We should all be accountable. We are here in this profession to educate the next generation. Very important work. Should testing be in that? Of course not. Because that's not why the tests were created. They were not created to be used in an evaluation. I can't think of any other profession, especially in this state, that has an evaluation system that uses things like testing to judge someone's ability to perform their job.
Okay. So what should an evaluation be based on?
We have a very good position on this, which is locally developed, locally controlled, with the school board, the teachers' union being involved, and let them collectively bargain this. We believe that their best interests are the interests of the students. So let them do it. I think the state has proven its inability to develop something that is useful.
And Andy, I think I can represent the listeners who may disagree with you, because I've heard it so many times on this program. I'm sure you've heard it. The argument that says, well, how can you tie testing to a teacher evaluation? Because after all, that's a teacher's job, to bring students along, to make sure they're learning, and that those tests are a determination of what the students need to be learning. So if the teacher is going to be evaluated, you have to know if they are teaching properly. I understand the arguments on all sides of this. That's roughly what we often hear for those who say, yes, tie the evaluations to testing. Why not, you know, why not say, hey, that's part of the job of the teacher?
There are hundreds of reasons why not. I think Jolene wants to speak to that.
So you have to make sure that the assessment is valid first. And if we feel like the trust in the system has been restored and that the assessment, in fact, is valid, then you know, that's one thing. But we're not there. And the other piece of it is this. Teachers have no problem being held accountable. And again, when we develop assessments locally and we have control over those assessments and we know that they're aligned to our instruction, I think we're proud of the results and we're happy to share them. And we look at them and we use them to improve our practice. But right now, the evaluation system as it is set up has been broken. The trust has not been completely restored. While we appreciate that the state tests have moved from 3 days to 2 days, more needs to be done to really fix the system. And we certainly believe that there are examples all over the state of teacher evaluation systems that worked prior to 2011, that had multiple measures, that had accountability in there, and that administrators and teachers felt very comfortable with. And so I believe we can go back to that.
All right, Tom and Brighton, next on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I'm calling about inquire about the teacher shortage and some of these forces that are impacting that. My daughter is completing her graduate studies at the U of R and will be entering the teaching force, I hope, next fall. I'm concerned about the fact that all of the violence that seems to visit itself on schools, the shortages that are showing up, the lack of funding, kind of the noble profession, but I am concerned that she's getting into a profession that's being written off by our communities and our societies. So if the speakers could address that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you for the phone call, Tom. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Tom, for your question. First of all, as a 25-year educator, I believe that there's no harder job in this country than being a school teacher. And I don't think there's a more important job than being a school teacher. And I think what we're seeing now across the country is that many people are feeling like their voices are not being heard. There are a lot of underserved populations, and they're looking to someone to do something, to make a change. And I believe the teaching profession is the way to make that change by teaching our young people to think for themselves, to be able to discern fact from fiction, to be able to rise up like we see the kids rising up all across this country and taking back what they know is right and good in this world and speaking out for those who don't have a voice. And I believe that teaching does that because we have that opportunity to kind of help shape young minds. I do believe that we need to restore trust in the education system, and that means policymakers need to start trusting the practitioners. And I think that we would start to see kids really coming back to this profession. I think that as teachers and as educators, we need to do a better job of actually tapping young people on the shoulder and saying, you would make a great teacher. You have these gifts. You have this. You have patience. You show empathy to others. You're bright. You're talented. You're creative. Have you thought about being a teacher? And we need to start growing our own programs in rural areas, in urban areas, in suburban areas, but particularly so that children, black and brown children, can look up at their teacher and see themselves in that person. So the more that we can do to really nurture kids and show them what a great profession it can be, I think that we would see people coming back. But it's going to take a lot of work, I think, all of us together to start talking about teaching in a different way.
When it comes to the shortage, though, and we hear a lot about the shortage, let me at least share what I heard from local districts when we were engaged in a research project two Decembers ago. I talked to Superintendent at East Rochester, who had been out at Avon, which is a more rural, of course, Jolene knows, more rural district here, talked to superintendents from Brighton, West Irondequoit. Just about everywhere I heard, the scenario was there isn't a whole lot of turnover, and when a job opens up, they can get 200 or 300 digital resumes, applications, etc., and that, you know, culling that down to 20 or so is difficult enough. But that there is a big number of people competing for a small amount of jobs. Now, this is a small geographic area. I don't know if this is the same in New York City, if this is the same in Albany, if this is the same in Cleveland and Rhode Island and Denver. But I do know that here the superintendents are telling me it's very competitive for a small amount of jobs that open up. And that doesn't sound like a shortage. But tell me where I'm going wrong, Julie.
Well, we believe that within the next decade, we're going to need 180,000 teachers here. And so we are concerned about the amount of teachers that we will need. You are seeing a lot of very veteran teachers decide that due to the pressures that policymakers are putting on them and the disrespect that we see, that they're leaving earlier than intended and they're retiring a little earlier. I don't believe that everywhere there is a shortage, but there are certainly shortages for bilingual teachers. We see shortages in family and consumer science. We certainly see shortages for CTE teachers. We will see shortages in math and science areas, I believe, because what you're seeing is students are going into college and they're making a choice on whether or not they kind of want to go to school for, you know, their master's degrees to become a teacher, to be maybe perhaps disrespected when they maybe could go and be a scientist. But our big thing is, would you rather be a scientist and certainly have a great impact on the world, or would you like to create hundreds of thousands of scientists in your career and really kind of have a much bigger impact in the world? So we believe that teaching is the way to go. And there are shortage areas that we are seeing, particularly candidates of color, which we would really like to encourage our children to become teachers so that they can be role models in their communities.
All right, Andy Pallotta, what's the story in New York State, you know, New York City and other parts of New York State where a lot of our listeners don't travel? What does the teacher situation look like there when jobs open up?
There's high turnover, and when you have high turnover, you are hurting the school environment. So we need to not only attract folks to the profession, we also need to keep them in the profession. And part of that goes back to what we discussed before, which was respect for the profession. So why would anyone want to go into a profession that they feel there's a negative narrative about it? Oh, the schools aren't working. Whatever it's been for the past few years, that has calmed down a lot. The rhetoric coming out of Albany, out of Washington, seems to have calmed down. But still, it has impacted young people that would go into teaching. So we definitely have got to speak to our local legislators, making sure that they value public education and value the teachers that, and professional staff that are in those buildings.
All right, a few minutes left with our guests from New York State United Teachers. One of the great traditions in the state is an executive budget comes out. It touts increases in education spending or ostensible increases, and then teachers get a hold of it and they say, not good enough. So let's talk about where you think the budget is not good enough, unless you think you're here to say, boy, it looks great. We're very satisfied. In fact, we think they've given us too much. My guess is you're not going to do that. So give me a sense, Andy, what you see out of this budget and what you're asking for from Albany.
Well, we saw from the executive budget, $769 million, which was a good start. We also saw the One House budget from the Assembly yesterday, I believe it was $1.2 billion. We've been asking for a minimum of $1.5 billion, and the regents also have been in that area, just to maintain current programs. So we do not believe there's enough in there at this point. And we do know that the legislature has been able to find some money in the cushions in Albany. They have found hundreds of millions of dollars, so we would hope that they would use that money to fund education more properly in the state.
Okay. Julian?
I concur.
Co-sign?
Yeah.
Are you optimistic that 1.5 number is achievable, Andy?
I am optimistic that we can do better than 769. Last year, the number was close to $1 billion in an increase in education funding, and I would hope that we at least get there this year.
Okay. Let me grab one more phone call. This is Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you for taking my call, Evan. They were talking about testing, and I don't think that testing shows the real individual when they do tests and they characterize the child by the test in which they took. And the reason I say that is I went in the Army in 1968. When I got ready to ETS out of the Army, they told me that I wouldn't be able to make it in society because of my test score. Well, since then, I've gone to college at RIT because they told me I couldn't make it. I went to college at RIT, and I've written a book which should be out in about 2 months. So those are the reasons. That's one of the reasons why I say that I don't think testing shows the real individual. They should come up with another way to test a person to really find out what a person is capable of doing. And just one more thing, they're talking about the money that they need for the educational system. When they get the money, give us a good product out of the system in which we invest the money in. And that way we won't have to, you won't have to keep going back asking, they'll give it to you. But as long as we're not getting a good product, it's hard to keep investing in something when you're not getting anything out of it.
All right, Sam, thank you. Andy, some tough comments on the last part. I know you both of you agree with Sam on some of the problems with testing, and that both of our guests have expressed their concerns with state testing and their desire to see more locally controlled testing. And so I think they agree with Sam there. But what about Sam saying, look, you got to spend the money well, and then, you know, they'll give you more the next time.
Right. I believe that some of the results that we're seeing now with high school graduation rates are phenomenal. So we've seen improvement year after year, and I think that is a foundation to where we need to be. Of course, we want to see 100% graduation rates, and that is our goal. So I think we had gone over some of the facts and figures on how things are getting better in the schools, and we have to tout that. And as far as believing that tests are the end-all, I'm totally in agreement with you, sir. And there are so many ways of evaluating the work that is done in a school building. And I believe a superintendent, a school board, a teachers union can get together and say, this is what works for us.
And Sam, I would just say, you know, late in the program, I didn't have time to follow up with you, but we can talk at a different time. What your specific concerns with how the money is sort of not being spent as you'd like to see, or how to get better results, no one is saying that the money can't be spent better or that things can't improve. On Friday on this program, we're going to talk about the Trevon Rowe tragedy this week and what happened inside a school that should never have happened. I mean, there are lessons to be learned in a lot of places. But I think it's also fair to say, as an evidence guy, as I like to say, you know, in impoverished districts, it is very, very difficult to move certain needles. And there's a much more complex problem than just NICET's control. That is not me being an apologist for NICET. But concentrated poverty is a very, very difficult situation to crack when it comes to educational outcomes as well. Sam, thanks for that. Let's talk separately about that. I want to thank our guests for coming in today. They're here from Albany and taking the time to talk to us in Rochester. Andy Pallotta is the president of NICET. Thanks. Let's do it again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Jolene DeBrango, executive vice president of NICET, and back near her home digs of Pittsford School District. Nice to have you back here, and thanks for taking the time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're talking school walkouts and a lot more tomorrow right here on Connections.